Great. So I make cough from time to time and fish out one of my little friendly lozenges. And the first thing I wanted to do was to just find out what that meditation was like for you. And then I consider it a challenge. I should have said at the beginning, this is Wednesday, 5th of May, right, 2010. And this talk and the meditation that I did are recorded and will be posted on my website, thekanson.net, as well as the wisebrain.org website for the Wellspring Institute. And also, last week's guided meditation was also recorded and is currently posted there, if you want to download it and listen to it. So, for starters, what was it like for you? Yeah, in the back there. And I should add, I consider what we tried to do here really a stretch, kind of improv, quite a challenge, and whatever happened, happened in the context of that. You know, kind of Black Diamond ski slope. We tried to make our way down without falling off a cliff. All right, please. I don't know, but you know what I do? I gently touch them.
So that's kind of like a fair thing.
For me, other people may object, but I find that it's courteous. It's not a deal, but it is mildly disruptive, and the person would probably usually rather be awake. You know? Now, there's a range of breathing sounds people make that are not quite snoring. That's all I would say. And if I notice it from up here, I will get up and I'll gently touch the person. Once in a while it happens. Is that okay with people? We've never really addressed that kind of housekeeping thing. Okay. All right. Yeah. Other comments? What was it like for you to try that practice? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
For me, rapture has a very out of self and the next has to be a step, but happiness seems like a rather more mundane. I wonder whether I understand happiness in the way that it's intended.
Yeah, great question. So his comment and question is about the steps that are, if I recall, the fourth and the fifth steps, where fourth step in this sequence that the Buddha laid out, we are to breathe in, experiencing rapture, breathe out, experiencing rapture. So what does that word rapture mean? The Pali word for it is piti, P-I-T-I, so that's what you'll hear sometimes people refer it to. It is one of the seven factors of enlightenment, and it is one of the five jhana factors, and it's also one of the characteristics of the first and second jhana, this feeling of rapture. So what in the world is it? People translate it in different ways. Some people call it bliss. I think of it as having two fundamental meanings. One is that one becomes enraptured with the object of attention, devoted to the breath, receiving the breath, given over to it, just lost in it. Sometimes you start to experience that, right? You're just, even for a moment, just for one breath, one inhalation, has not probably nearly everyone in this room, if not everyone, experienced at one moment or another that sense of just being like, holy moly. you know? Okay, that's one meaning. The second meaning refers to fairly marked feelings of bodily pleasure that often have a quality of pulsing. In other words, they're transient. They just kind of, like little rushes or like quickenings. Those feelings in the body often have a rising quality. Somebody's felt the rising in the back, coming up the front. They sometimes seem to occur in parallel with quickening of inhalation. It's all right, I think, and not cheating, to do little things to encourage them. In longer practices, it's quite common to encounter this kind of bodily pleasure and even really become almost overwhelmed by it. And the line of the Buddha is that one should saturate oneself with rapture, as this is a fairly antiquated notion, but as a bath man or woman saturates bath powder with water to form a doughy ball, or I think of it as bread dough. Much as we are to saturate flour with milk to form bread dough, you know, so too should we saturate every bit of our body with rapture. I mean, that's the encouragement. You know, so that's kind of a high bar. That's not easy to do in just a come on in Wednesday night, sit down, okay, 20 minutes in, time for some rapture. You know, so anything you get is good, right? That's what that is. Okay, and then happiness, or sometimes it's translated as joy. It has a certain sweetness to it. Gladness is sometimes another word that is used. A teacher of mine, Christina Feldman, speaks of a kind of a continuum of joy, including happiness, contentment, and tranquility. I think all those are fair game. Very often the feeling of joy is not like the feeling of joy one gets at, you know, winning an election or, you know, your favorite team winning or, you know, getting some kind of incredibly good news or something like that. It often is a very spacious just sense of quiet mindfulness. I mean, quiet well-being, of which one's mindful, but quiet well-being, like contentment or peacefulness or basic gladness. And also as well, I think it's okay to do little things to call up that feeling of happiness so that it becomes present, and then it gets woven into the breath and becomes in some ways then, you know, woven into the object of attention. With practice, honestly, you become more able to just almost on a dime activate these feelings. Like honestly, I'm kind of in the mid-range of people who can activate or access rapture and bliss. Some people are very blissful. Some people are very just, it doesn't ignite, you know? But now it will, I can bring up that feeling. It kind of amazed me when I first started tipping into it. And you'll also get very automatic at being able to open to happiness, contentment, and tranquility with practice. You know, neurons that fire together wire together, including, you know, happiness. All right, another person or two, then I want to move on. Yeah. The feeling tone, feeling, labeling it. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. So the first point is to appreciate the distinction, really, which a friend of mine was talking with me about this morning, between being and function. And what I mean by that is to track the distinction between our natural state, being already all right. You know, our natural state is naturally calm, contented, and caring. Creative, generative, wise, awake. That's the deepest level. You know, I'm perfectly convinced of that. And that's the witness and of the great teachers and the great awakened people. They all say the same thing. They could be an Eskimo shaman, a New York rabbi, or a mystic, you know, out of Tibet. And they all say basically the same thing. The ground condition is mysteriously radiant, loving, and awake. That's our ground. It's also the case that we experience that ground and we live as that into the world. How much of the time? Not that much of the time, you know? It kind of shines through. Some people have more transparent stained glass windows than others. And at different moments, you know, our stained glass is more transparent. And we each have our own little stained glass type array that light shines through. But much of the time, it's pretty obscured, isn't it? So then we do, I know I'm doing my Karate Kid imitation here, wipe on, wipe off, but, you know, we polish, we clear things out, right, so the light can shine through better. And that's where function comes. We become more functional. We do practices. So both are true. And it is a pitfall to get caught up in function and self-improvement and seeking and spiritual materialism and piling up attainments and feeling inadequate if one doesn't have attainment or frustrated, let's say, not being able to activate, you know, rapture on cue, right? And those are pitfalls to be careful about that are inherent in trying to get better at anything. This is a path of training the mind, you know. The traditional sequence is know the mind, shape the mind, free the mind. So we're in the knowing and shaping phase a lot with this meditation, moving into freeing, particularly in the later steps of the mindfulness of breathing, you know, sutta. And so try to hold those two together. In other words, yes, make wise effort. That question was brought up, you know, last time. Wise effort is one of the elements of the Eightfold Path. Wise intention is one of the elements of the Eightfold Path. We make efforts. We have intentions. And it's also very helpful, as well as being true, to continue to appreciate and open to just the natural ground of things. And relax into it and not get too stressed, right, about practices of various kinds. Including wherever one is in the steps. And also it's okay, I think it's like, on the one hand, it's good to honor the lineage. I had teachers in my early 20s that really came out of no lineage, and they wreaked a lot of havoc. Now teachers who come out of lineage, whether it's, you know, priests molesting people, or you know, Buddhist teachers having sex with their students, they can still get into trouble. The lineage really helps. There's a place for lineage. Respecting the lineage, know what you're trying to transcend. I mean, when I went to graduate school in psychology, and I did three of them, God help us, and one of the three was in psychoanalysis. And I had a lot of skepticism about it, but it's classic. I wanted to understand it. If I was going to go beyond it or differ with it, I wanted to know why, you know? So know the lineage. So I think there's a place for doing the traditional practices, you know, and seeing where they take you. And on the other hand, it's totally okay to not be trapped by them. The Buddha offered so many methods, and he evolved his methods as he went along. And Buddhism itself has tremendously evolved in 2,500 years. So, for example, I find myself, when I'm doing this mindfulness of breathing practice, I go really quickly into breathing as the whole body, and really quickly into happiness. PT or rapture kind of doesn't do much for me. You know, I do a little bit of it to kind of get the juices flowing. And then after that, I'm really into more of the insight part of it. Going after, for example, the sixth and seventh step, which we did here, which is really observing the flow of the feeling tone and then the perceiving function. Whatever works for you. Okay. The other thing I wanted to say, and I hope I'm not over-speaking here, was about the second thing you brought up. Remind me again. I'm a little spacey.
The
Oh, noting. The noting practice, yeah. So now, in the traditional suttas of Buddhism, I personally can't find any noting practices. We are to be mindful of things. We are to know them, right? So there's probably some little bit of inherent labeling there. But the noting practice really came from Mahasi Sayadaw, Rima. Mahasi, which is an honorific, or rather, that's his name, Sayadaw is an honorific, who's a great teacher, really a great teacher, and was a major teacher for Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and many of the teachers in the Western Vipassana tradition. And one of Mahasi's practices is to note, and to note incredibly much. And if you want to read his practice, it's kind of stunning the degree to which you do the noting. Read his part of Jack Kornfield's anthology, Living Dharma, which summarizes all these Buddhist teachers. It's very powerful. And I've had teachers I respect, you know, recommend it to me. On the other hand, a lot of people, me included, think, I don't get it. Because one, so much is happening, and it's not happening simultaneously. It's not just happening sequentially, like a computer chip runs the same stream in a normal computer of zeros and ones through one gate. So the speed of the processor, like 2.16 gigahertz, is the number of bits it can move per second through that single gate. That's how a processor works in a computer, right? The brain is a network. It's not a single gate. So there's all this stuff going on simultaneously. For one thing, if you're labeling, you've got so much to label at the same time, particularly if you're kind of aware. And then the other thing is, it's going on so fast, by the time you even generate a word to note it, you know, so you have to go through recognizing, finding the word, producing the word in your mind, which takes about a quarter of a second or a whole, you know, per word even. Just the word itself takes half a second to kind of utter or know in your mind. The thing is gone, right? And it's been replaced by four other things. Kind of, you know. So, and then the other thing is you're activating the verbal systems. Left side of the brain for most people. So I think the use of it, and I speak under advisement and with respect, I've never done this practice deeply. I'm sure there are people I respect who've done it deeply, got a lot out of it. But the takeaway is, forgive the expression, shit happens. In other words, so much is going on. It's so transient, it's so impermanent, it's so fast, that it's just silly stupid to try to grab onto any of it at the waterfall edge of now. That's the takeaway. And if you get that, you don't need to torture yourself by labeling every bit of mental content. That's what I think about it. Now, from time to time, it's quite helpful, especially if something's bugging us, like worry. As soon as you label it, it loses its power. Studies have shown that just labeling negative emotions activates the prefrontal cortex and quiets the amygdala, the alarm bell in the brain. So, restlessness. Blah. Wondering when this damn sitting is going to be over. You know? Snoring. Why are they snoring? Criticism of people who snore. It's useful to do that. It's metacognition. You know, it's bird's eye view, you're labeling it. But don't do it past the point of response. So now I want to do something if we could. You know, you can always opt out of anything I suggest. In a moment, I suggest that you find a partner, pick an A and a B. A's always go first. What you'll do, one person will mainly speak, the A's will mainly speak, the B's will mainly listen. Then at the end of 3 minutes, I'll ring the bell and you'll reverse roles. And what I'd like you to talk about is the role of liking and disliking in your life. In other words, how do likes and dislikes get you going for better and for worse? In other words, what's productive and helpful and pro-happiness, pro-benefit for you in liking or disliking. But especially, I encourage you to spend at least two-thirds of your 3 minutes on the costs of getting caught up in liking or disliking, particularly in this larger frame of Buddhism, in which we seek to become free of these reactive chains, these reactive cascades of, you know, the stimulus occurs, there's a contact with the stimulus, then there's a feeling tone, pleasant or unpleasant, and some kind of labeling as well, moving very quickly to liking or disliking, and then craving, clinging, suffering. Right? Okay, so everybody pick a partner if you're willing to. Turn to your partner, feel free to spread out a little bit. Don't start yet. Okay, if you want a partner and don't have one, please raise your hand. Okay, great, this was fast. Oh, you'd like a partner and don't have one? Anybody else want a partner or doesn't have one? You could be my partner. That means you get to go both ways. What? Okay. Oh, you want it, Nancy? You want a partner? Okay, there you are, you two. Good. Okay, pick an A and a B. Try to talk softly if you could, otherwise it'll become a hubbub in here. Okay? So, likes and dislikes in your life, especially focused on the ways they make you and others suffer. All right? A's begin. Like the exercise. Others, what did you get out of liking, disliking, pleasant, unpleasant, pleasure, pain, you know, approach, avoid, all that, this primal, you know, insect, lizard, monkey, squirrel, human, dynamic. Yeah. How about you back there? Yeah. Pursue something you want that's not good for you, or to stop resisting something that you have aversion towards, that is creating problems to resist. You mean that kind of moment? Yeah. But some things we should keep doing, like liking an exercise like this, it's probably wholesome, or liking water on a hot day. There's a place, liking our children, right? And moving towards that. Very, very good. The problem arises when it's a problem. Well, I think the practice here is to start to really appreciate the mechanical automaticity, you know, of liking, labeling, or, you know, often called the feeling of value. The feeling comes in something called evaluation, where we, you know, it's pleasant or it's unpleasant. So it's basically the feeling tone, labeling, and then action. Just like how fast it is. And it's right there, I think, that helps us become more disciplined. It's right here. I'm like a little robot, honestly. And you start really appreciating how kind of robotic and how automatic and how quick. Now, most of the time, they're holding it already. That itself is kind of helpful. Second thing is to try to ground increasingly in that natural state of happiness that is fired through the rewards of getting what we like or the rewards of getting rid of what we dislike. It's, you know what I mean? It's, if you're already kind of awash in well-being, so what? You see something pretty in the window. Or someone offers you a yummy cupcake. Kind of nice, but I'm already feeling really good. You know, it's like somebody offers you something at a party you don't really want to take. Pass it. No thanks, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm already good. Thank you. It's not a problem. I'm already good. And that's where I think the cultivation of happiness is. And one reason why it's such an important part of Dharma practice. To just build moral structure, build those rules of your own way of well-being, which may well hold sorrow and fear and anger and pain. And yet that well-being is so critical to practice, because it increasingly over time, it starts to kind of wash out. All these other little bits of grasping come over us, or resistance come over us. And then I think, the last thing I'll say about it from a practical standpoint is to is to replace the things we like with higher pleasures. You know, the Buddha talked about replacing worldly pleasures with unworldly ones. Replacing the kind of base pleasure, if you will, of driving to a sale in telemarketing with, if you will, a higher pleasure. And it's okay, I've been there. You know, with a higher pleasure of kind of gladdening the heart. And similarly, with regard to dealing with what we dislike, it's harder. Because, honestly, we're kind of organized around aversion. We're more organized around aversion than we are around greed, if you will. Because sticks were much more consequential in evolution than carrots. Unpleasant feeling tones were much more important signals than pleasant ones on the whole. You know what I mean? Here? This is kind of a quick summary of a big nugget I've talked about a lot. So, it's interesting then, for example, wise intention. 2 out of 3 of the elements of wise intention in the Eightfold Path have to do with aversion. Non-harming, the intention not to harm, and second, the intention to not have ill will, to not, in effect, hate things out there. And then the other one, of course, is renunciation, which goes more towards desire. But it also is applies to renouncing going to war with the things we don't like. You know, so it's a hard one. And people vary, too. Some people are more aversive in their nature, right? I live with 3 people, and they, you know, well, they live with me too, God help them, but there are 4 of us, and we range, you know, in the degree to which things are unpleasant. And that's just people who have a nature, you know. And if it's your nature to find things fairly often as unpleasant, then I think it's useful to be helpful to yourself, so, and be kind to yourself, and appreciate that you're kind of afflicted with aversiveness. Just like some people are afflicted with greed, some people by doubt, some people by aversiveness. And it's kind of, and be kind to yourself about it, right? And then one thing that I will do is I'll ask myself, how bad is this really? And very often the thing that I think is bad, I was thinking here earlier about what I call, what grows to me, anticipatory Vedana. In other words, Vedana. The Vedana is the Pali term for the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Western psychology calls it the hedonic tone. It's honestly ground zero for the engine of suffering. Because that feeling tone very quickly activates craving, clinging, suffering, large and small. Much of the time now, there isn't even a feeling tone. We're anticipating a feeling tone. Like, for example, for me, I am so flooded with tasks that I just kind of now live in this silly, stupid task world that I'm trying to get out of. And a lot of the time, what I'll notice is that I'll think of something to do, like respond to an email or something, and then there'll be anticipatory disquiet at what will happen if I don't get that task done. Right? Or alternately, we think about, oh, I'll go to Chinese, or I'll go out to Italian tonight, or I'll do this, or I'll do that. We anticipate a reward, like that we get caught up in the pleasant feeling tone. And yet, how good is it really? It usually doesn't turn out. The simulator makes things much more dramatic and intense than they normally really are in most of life. And that's really true, I think, for unpleasant experiences. They're usually not that bad, you know, but we can bear them and so forth. Or we just let it be what it is. We don't have to make it. Maybe it's simply unpleasant, but we don't have to dislike the unpleasant. I mean, I think one thing that this meditation takes us to is a really, really deep teaching or inquiry in that's so felt and immediate into freedom or slavery. You know? Because in effect, there are levels of activation. Baseline, the natural state, is fairly quiet, peaceful, contented. It can have spikes of joyful activation, like at the good fortune of others. But mainly, it's fairly mellow, right? Even though it's very peaceful, very happy, very all right, very kind of benign, kind of a blessing disposition, teacher mind called it. That's sort of like level one. You know, level zero is when you're asleep or unconscious, right? Level one, you're mildly activated, you're awake, and you're in the natural state, and it's all right. I think a lot of us tasted that tonight. It's all right. Then level two is pleasant or unpleasant. There's a feeling to it. Interestingly, level three is liking or disliking. Because something can be pleasant, and you don't have to like it. You notice that? The brain is just automatically, the animal brain is registering, oh, that's pleasant. But we don't have to particularly like it. It's just pleasant. Or something is unpleasant. We don't have to dislike it. Right there, you're starting to break the chains of slavery to the stream of reactions. Events occur, stimuli occur. You're pleasant or unpleasant is often constructed. It doesn't need to follow the event. And then let's say it does. Then what can follow pleasant or unpleasant is liking or disliking. It doesn't need to follow pleasant or unpleasant. Investigate this. And then, even if there's liking or disliking, wanting, you know, wanting what we like to continue and grow or wanting what we dislike to, you know, shrink and go away, doesn't have to fall. You see that sequence? That sequence is really worth following, because if we get carried along by it, and we're naturally, the lizard, the inner squirrel, the inner monkey, lives to be hijacked by that sequence, because that's what helps that squirrel find the nuts, right? Or run from the hawk. And that's got us here today. But on the other hand, that sequence is mechanical, you know, very primal, mostly not very meaningful, and can draw us into all kinds of trouble. Right? Freedom is to have a kind of enormous spaciousness around all that, so that, first of all, it gets quieted. There's a lot of teaching around tranquilizing, calming, quieting, cooling the fires. You know, one of the chapters in Buddha's brain is cooling the fires. It's interesting how often people have written about this. The Buddha uses metaphors of cooling. You may know this already, that the word for nirvana or nibbana is to blow out or extinguish like a candle or to cool down. People talk about taking a pot of rice off the fire. Literally, in the colloquial expression, they're nibbana-ing it. See what I mean? They're cooling it down. There's so much about that. He has a sutta called the Fire Sutta, where he says the world is burning. You know, and it's both, you know, phenomena are just burning up almost. But more than that, the mind is burning. You know, the world as it manifests in our mind is burning. And then we live in a culture that's like a big bonfire, right? You have Tom Wolfe writing a book called The Bonfire of the Vanities. So, and so, just to wrap here. We wrap it with spacious mindfulness. We cool down increasingly. And then increasingly we install buffers that become increasingly automatic, particularly for bigger, more and more intense stuff, and stuff where we're more and more deeply reactivated. And that's a beautiful path of practice. We install these buffers where increasingly events occur and they can be surrounded with enormous tranquil neutrality. And then some of them leak through that and become pleasanter and pleasant. That's all right. It's very natural. Okay? And then we install kind of a buffer where there's just the pleasant. There's just the unpleasant. In the seen, let there be only the seen. In the pleasant, let there be only the pleasant. It doesn't have to move to liking or disliking. And then even if it does, another buffer. Liking and disliking doesn't have to move to, you know, grasping or resisting. And that, just that, is the end of suffering. So, let's let this sink in for a minute. And then we'll call it a wrap tonight. Let's just sit for 1 minute. Thank you for your beautiful attention. And next week, I'll tell you what, I can see there's a lot of discussion here about this, and I appreciated you letting me go. And so next week what we'll do is we'll do this practice, I think, again, and then we'll just mostly really open it up for more discussion. Okay, so thank you again. You're welcome.